Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. Hello and welcome to the Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we're joined by S&C coach and head of athlete performance and development at Xavier College in Melbourne, Nathan Heaney, also known as the conditioning consultant on social media. Now, more people are becoming familiar with training programs involving training zones. You might have heard of 80-20 running, where you do 80% of your runs in the easy domain and 20% of your run in the hard, more intense domain. But is it as easy as keep your easy runs easy and your hard runs hard? Like, what defines these training zones? Well, in this episode, Nathan and I discuss how we can use heart rate data to define these training zones. What's the difference between a 5-zone model and a 3-zone model, and how we could potentially use RPE to guide our training in each of these zones. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram, YouTube, and head to our website, theprogresstheory.com. Check out all of our other episodes. But before we get into the episode, I just want to tell you a little bit about our sponsors, because without them, this podcast would not be possible. I wanted to express my gratitude to my production partner, Cult Media. Cult Media has been instrumental in the development and success of The Progress Theory. They have created brand guides, comprehensive podcast strategies, enhanced the podcast production, developed custom workflows for me, and edited and mixed all of the video, audio, and social media content. Cult Media's simple coach, create, and collaborate process has saved me hundreds of hours in podcast production, resolved countless technical issues, and consistently helped me to improve my podcasting game. So if you want to establish and engage your audience, or are ready to launch your own podcast, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to learn more. Also, thank you to Human24, fueling human potential and optimizing everyday human performance and well-being. The supplement range at Human24 not only helps improve your lifestyle, it optimizes it. The Human24 products are designed to fit around your circadian rhythms, from the moment you wake up to key moments in the day when you need optimal focus to getting the best night's sleep. There is a product to optimize each phase of the day. My personal favorite is the Live On Form Pack, consisting of the products Rise, Flow, and Pre-Sleep. Rise is for the morning, and it's my absolute favorite. It's a drink that tastes amazing, it hydrates me, and improves my focus to win the morning. At 2 p.m., I take Flow, which is a caffeine-free nootropic, perfect for improving alertness and concentration during that mid-afternoon slump. And finally, I take Pre-Sleep just before bed, which is a comprehensive nighttime complex, perfect to support a performance-driven lifestyle. Check out the website www.hmn24.com for all their products, articles, and links to their awesome podcast for those wanting to learn more about human performance. You can even check out the episode I did with them. I thoroughly enjoyed my chat with Phil Lerney, co-founder of Human24, and it has led to an awesome collaboration with Human24 supporting the Progress Theory. If you want a 10% discount on all Human24 products, head to their website via the links in our Instagram bios of the Progress Theory or my personal Instagram account at Dr. Phil Price, or use the code Phil Price at checkout. Here is Nathan Heaney. Nathan, how are we?
I'm good, Phil. Thanks for the invite, and thanks for having me on your Progress Theory podcast.
No problem. I've been looking forward to this because training intensity distribution is a topic that I think has gained a lot of popularity. People are becoming more aware of, you know, make your hard runs hard and make your easy ones easy, rather than just go out and see if you can run at like 90% each time. But I still think it's a little bit of a gray area. People don't understand where those zones are. So, you know, I think it's great to have you on the show and really clarify those things up.
Yeah. I certainly agree with you. I think it's a topic, I guess the overarching concept of training intensity distribution has probably been popularized by the fact that the concept of polarized training has become much more commonly used, particularly endurance training circles. So I think by virtue of that being more popular, I think people have started to get a bit of an appreciation for, well, what is training intensity distribution and how do I use that to polarize my training? Yeah, it's certainly been a really interesting topic and one that I've, you know, certainly been using a lot with my athletes over the last few years.
Mm. Before we delve into the topic, do you want to give a bit of an overview of yourself?
Yeah, no problems. So based in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, I guess my background sort of stems from like a high performance setting. So I studied at a university in Melbourne and that was a sports science degree. I guess one thing for me, I was fortuitous enough whilst I was undertaking the study to do an internship at the Victorian Institute of Sport. So it's probably similar to you guys have state or national institutes. So we have state institutes here. So it'd be a similar model where we service the Olympic athletes. And I was fortuitous enough to be an intern there. Anyway, as it turned out, I ended up finishing my uni degree, finishing some further study, which focused specifically at conditioning application, particularly aerobic conditioning application within a team sport setting. So the overarching aim for me was, how do I make myself more employable? Because jobs were few and far between, and it's a pretty competitive marketplace here, as it would be in the UK too. The research pertained aerobic conditioning application in team sport settings. So whilst I was doing that, I was fortunate enough to progress to part-time and then full-time employment. I ended up being at the VIS for about 10 years. And then from there, I left and went to work at AFL Victoria and then the Adelaide Crows, which is a football team that compete in the Australian Football League. So I was there for 3 years and that was awesome. And I was the role I served there was strength and conditioning coordinator. So I oversaw the strength training and running conditioning, overarching conditioning component of the football club. And then more recently, the last 2 years, I have been at Xavier College as head of athlete performance and development. So that's one of our big private schools here in Melbourne. So my role is primarily to provide strength and conditioning and sports science support through the broader department to our most aspirational sportsmen and our sporting teams. So yeah, it's been a bit of a slightly change in tact, but certainly love the role. Like it's a nice blend of developmental servicing, but really focusing on some of our high-end sports. So yeah, that's a succinct overview.
That's a really nice mixed experience. So you've gone from working with elite Olympic athletes to elite team athletes to the developmental athletes, and each one comes with certain criteria, don't they? They, you know, it's a really different experience with each one. So how did those different experiences lead to you developing these ideas around aerobic conditioning? Because I'm assuming the aerobic conditioning started when you were working with the Olympic athletes and something you've carried on through and really sort of perfected over time.
Yeah, great question. So absolutely, like when I was at the VIS, I vividly remember during my initial stages there, I was kind of looking at the conditioning being applied. I was kind of thinking to myself, I thought there's got to be a slightly better way to do some of this stuff. Like I felt like it was a little bit subjective and it probably lacked a bit of precision. And I guess I've always been someone that's been a little bit more analytical with the way I approach things. So yeah, by virtue of that, I then went down the path of undertaking some of the study. As soon as I did that, I would say that year of study was probably my steepest learning curve from a pure literature standpoint. So that was awesome. And from there, I guess I just started developing my interest. So whether it was for team sport athletes initially, but then I started working with some more endurance athletes, and then that opens up another avenue of learning. So I guess it's, it definitely started when I was at the VIS. And then I guess as I got exposed to different athletes, different populations, different groups, different settings, the type of research you look at and the application just changes. So, yeah, I guess then it morphs into something a little bit different to what you initially started investigating or applying.
Have you found your methods that you've developed over time, is it something that you could potentially use with all training groups, or do you find the application becomes different with each training group that you work with?
Yeah, I would say the overarching philosophy probably stays relatively consistent, but certainly the application of the philosophy, so the methods you're implementing, they definitely change. So they are what I would say much more group specific. So there's so much context that underpins aerobic conditioning application. So a team sport group is that fundamentally is in a skill-based sport. The application of conditioning for them is so different to a triathlete or a middle distance runner. Like they're just chalk and cheese. And there's just much more, I guess it's just a much more complex environment to apply conditioning in, because there's so many factors that you need to consider when you're prescribing conditioning in that setting. But not to discount the complexity with endurance sports, it's just the complexity is different.
Yeah. I feel like I've opened up a tangent with that question, because I'm now thinking like, towards the sort of like team sports, the sorry, intermittent type based sports like hockey, football, rugby. But I know that we are in this series focusing on developing strength and endurance simultaneously, more focused around, okay, could you combine powerlifting or weightlifting up with developing your ability within triathlon, for example. So I might stick down that route if that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's next time.
Yeah, exactly. Round two. We've already booked it. Could you start off with just giving an overview of what training intensity distribution is? And then we can go from there, just in case anyone listening is not too familiar with the concept.
Yeah, no problem. So training intensity distribution, it's the best way to think about it is the quantification of physical activity or exercise across a specific time period. So that can include your training intensity distribution for a single session, or 1 week, 1 month, half a year, or a full annualized year. So that's kind of, I guess, how people look at it, like overarchingly. And the aim of training intensity distribution is to provide an overview of one's training intensity. So for example, how much high intensity work are they completing? How much moderate or threshold work are they completing? How much high intensity work are they completing over those specific time periods? So more often than not, it's done through the collection and quantification of heart rate data. So the main rationale for heart rate being used is that it enables multi-mode assessment. So imagine you work with a triathlete. So if you're trying to quantify their training, you're trying to do it across three disciplines. I know there is a little bit of complexity around quantification of training and monitoring heart rate in the pool, but now through the advent of different sensors, optical sensors, you can track heart rate a bit more accurately in the pool. So by virtue of using an optical sensor in the pool and then your traditional heart rate measurement on a bike or running, you can literally capture heart rate data across all three modes for the entire training day, training week, training month, etc. Yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. And I guess the other element that's worth noting is that it provides athletes, coaches, and practitioners alike with information about the intricacies of their endurance training program. So, yeah, we're going to delve a bit deeper in some of the subsequent questions.
And recently, I know I put it up on Instagram that I watched an online lecture of yours, which really explained when you start to see people. Okay, let me reframe it as in, okay, you've got the intense, moderate, and easy.
Yep.
And people are going for an easy run, but it ends up being moderate. Or they go for a hard run, but it ends up being moderate. So they've got a particular goal that they have to achieve, but they end up missing that goal. And then the accumulation of that over time can lead to either stagnation or some kind of injury. But in this particular YouTube presentation that you gave, you really nicely described what a easy run that ended up being moderate looked like, and also the same for the hard run. Do you want to give like a bit of an overview of that?
I'll also
in the show notes put a link to that particular presentation of yours.
Okay, no problem. So the easiest way to contextualize that is imagine everyone, a lot of your listeners probably run to heart rate or have run to heart rate before, or exercise to heart rate. So imagine you had a specific threshold that was your easy or anaerobic, or sorry, aerobic threshold. So that's your, that basically demarcates easy from moderate. So for most people, and it's, again, it's not gold standard, but generally 80% heart rate max is that threshold. So imagine if you were going out to do an easy run and the prescription was to use 80% as your easy ceiling. So people that don't execute easy runs well, what they end up doing is they end up running, they'll start the run successfully and the heart rate will be below 80% heart rate max. But what ordinarily happens for most people, and this is definitely relevant through the conditioning consultant side business where I'm working a lot with endurance athletes, they ordinarily just gradually creep up over the course of the whole run. So heart rate's just gradually trickling up. And by the end of the run, they're probably not far off 90% heart rate max. And by virtue of gradually seeing their heart rate trickle up, their average heart rate is smack bang in the moderate or threshold zone. So they end up accruing and accumulating lots of time in that threshold zone. So what was supposed to be an easy run is definitely not an easy run at that point. There's a few different layers to this. I guess there's some really good papers, one by Craig Neal, who looked at the impact of high intensity work and threshold work on immunity and suppression of immunity. And it definitely shows that hard runs and moderate runs have a pretty similar cost in terms of your immune response. So, and that's also been backed up by some work where people are comparing impact of those types of runs to your HRV. So I think that's probably a good example of where an easy run can go wrong. So, and I think that lecture you referred to has a graphical context to it too. So you can really see where this particular athlete, they were supposed to do an easy run. They ended up averaging like 6 or 8 beats per minute higher than they were supposed to. The pace was much faster. So in the end, it was a really poorly executed easy run, which definitely has a cost associated with it, which when they try and do a hard run later on in the week, they probably can't do it as well because they haven't enabled their body to recover by virtue of banking that sort of easier intensity run.
Yeah, always make sure that you're recovered for the hard sessions, isn't it? You know, if you've got key sessions during the week, which are the most intense ones, everything else has to be geared around making sure those intense ones are intense, because if you then screw that up by going too intense in the other sessions, then you're kind of just hitting this middle of the road for all of your training. I've been guilty of that in the past.
Oh, and it's such a common issue. Like, and I think for me, like I hadn't worked with, I guess, not weekend warriors, but sub-elite athletes all that much until the last couple of years when I by virtue of starting the side business, which is obviously how you found me. So I would say it is unbelievably relevant for them because more often than not, most people would, I would say 90% of most people that I work with, their go-to exercise mode or intensity is exactly what you described. It's just a moderate intensity that might trickle to a high intensity at the back end of the run as they manage a sprint finish to the line. So most people don't really have the discipline or the restraint or the patience to actually run easy enough. Like it's so counterintuitive, but it's actually really hard to run easy. So it just requires a lot of those aforementioned qualities. And then in contrast, when you set people hard sessions to do, most people don't have the intestinal fortitude to do that properly either. And what I mean by that is they don't actually lay it all out there and work hard enough to achieve it. So they end up converging most of their training in that middle zone. So it's certainly a different model, and one that for some people, you know, it's completely unfamiliar and they've never trained that way before. But certainly I've had, since applying it with a vast array of endurance athletes and team sport athletes via the TCC side business, I've been using similar models with high performance athletes, it's one that's proven to be really effective from an adaptation standpoint and also robustness, longevity, all those types of things as well.
Yeah. What kind of, I don't want to use the word excuses, but What are the reasons that the weekend warriors that you've worked with end up going towards or converging towards that moderate intensity? Because in my head, I'm thinking, okay, people I've worked with in the past, usually it is our work caught up with me. So then I had less time to run. So I only did half of it. So to make the most of it, I then ran faster. So your easy run just ended up being more intense than it should have been. Or for the opposite of that, when it comes to the hard work, there's like, work was really hard. I just ended up not working as hard in the session as I want. It's almost like external factors end up being, I don't want to say the excuse, but there might be a little bit towards that and not actually following the plan as much as they could do. Do you find something similar in your athletes? Well, the weekend warriors anyway.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think if I start with the easy runs first and people's inability to do them effectively, I think some of it comes down to a lack of knowledge and education. Like, they actually just don't know any better. So ordinarily for them, I think, again, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but here certainly physical activity is a bit of an issue more in like broader society. So for weekend warriors, they might think, well, anything I'm doing, like the harder I work, the better. Like, isn't that the best approach? But I guess when they start transitioning across to more goal-orientated endurance training, they then realize that that type of approach isn't sustainable. Because when you start banking 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 Ks a week or 300 Ks a week on the bike, when you start banking that type of training volume in, just doing moderate training all the time is not going to cut it, because you are going to end up leading to, you know, you're going to leave yourself susceptible to injury, illness, overtraining, overreaching, all those types of things. Not to mention that that type of training results in high levels of training monotony. You know, people end up burning out. They go, oh, you know, I'm sick of this training. I've got these niggles. I can't get rid of them. I haven't improved. So I'm going to give up. You know, so I think a bit of it is a lack of knowledge and education. I think also it probably comes from maybe, I think there's definitely a lack of discipline in it. So I think for some people, when you set them easy runs to do, for so long they've exercised thinking harder is better, harder is better. So when you tell them to run easier, they're like, what do you mean? Like, I don't feel like I'm getting anything out of it. So it probably takes the complementary nature of the high intensity work for the penny to drop. So when you actually show them the easy runs and they start to do them and they go, yeah, okay, I can see I'm starting to enjoy these. I start to feel the benefit. I feel like I can do them and not, they don't come with a significant cost or impost on my freshness and wellness and all those types of things. But then when you complement it and juxtapose it with the high intensity work, that's when I think the penny drops and they go, geez, yeah, that, like, now I can see what you mean. I've never worked that hard before for a high intensity session. And then they're like, ah, okay, so maybe my ability to perform them is better now because I am fresher. So I think it's the combination of those two where people finally understand why you would approach your training in this manner. Because for most people, you know, they don't have the knowledge, the awareness, and they will cite excuses like you're alluding to. So time, you know, oh, I only had 30 minutes, so that's all I could fit in. So I just went as hard as I could for 30 minutes. So all those things are the same factors that you referred to, Phil. But I think the overarching issue is, I think people just do not know any better. I think that's probably the major issue. And hopefully through your podcast, and I guess part of it for me, like the reason I set up the side business, like I've always been not anti social media, but like not that comfortable putting stuff out there, in particularly in these types of forums. But I think it was just a realization that conditioning application is so misapplied and misunderstood. So I was like, well, I do have what I perceive as a good body of knowledge. So it's probably a good thing to share to people that are interested. Mm. So hence why I started it about, you know, roughly about 2 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. The more we can get this out here, the better. And on top of developing people's base knowledge, you know, it's good appropriate coaching to lead that person for that realization of what they're doing is actually going to head them in the right direction. Recently, I've wanted to use, because I definitely see this, if I see on a Strava and I'll see someone that I follow that has done, I don't know, a 15K run, and they go, yeah, it's my easy run. And I'll look at the speed and I think, well, that's quite a fast speed. But then you go for the average heart rate and it's like 130. And that's when I get jealous. I don't get jealous of these super like, oh, you know, what's your 5K PB? I'm jealous of those that can run 20K at a decent speed that's maintained and keep their heart rate right down, because I know that I can't do that. I mean, I'm 95 kilos, so that's probably going to affect my running ability. It makes a big difference. But still, it's, you know, I see that and I think, okay, maybe people need to stop thinking about the absolute, you know, high performance of someone's PB. Maybe, you know, their ability to perform this base work should be led towards something that, oh, you know, I want that. I want to be able to run at that speed at that low heart rate. That's what I want my steady state to be. But hopefully with more stuff like this and the, you know, the information you're putting out on your Instagram page is going to make more people aware of all this. So it's, I think it's great.
Hopefully.
What are the different intensity distributions? So we've talked a lot about polarized training. So I don't know, let's use the whole 80-20 because that's gained quite a lot of popularity where 20% of your work will be in that high intensity domain and then the rest, the 80% will be in that low intensity domain. So if we're thinking of a three zone model, the 80% will be in zone one and then 20% will be in zone three. Obviously, you need to move between between those zones. So you're not going to have zero in zone two, but that's the one that's popularized. Why is polarized training so popular? Is there like a strong evidence base to support it?
Yeah. So yes, there is. So I guess we'll start with the polarized TID model. So the reason that's become much more popular, and it's certainly fantastic that it has become a lot more popular and I guess a lot more commonly utilized with endurance athletes of all abilities is because there was quite a bit of research done through, I guess, largely the Scandinavian countries, whereby they looked at a whole heap of cross-country skiing and winter sport endurance athlete case studies. And the findings from those studies highlighted that a lot of these really successful athletes, so we're talking Olympic gold medalists, when they broke down and analyzed their training data, they realized that by and large, the vast majority of their training was spent in the low intensity domain. So, and then when you think about it, like it's pretty intuitive. When you think about an endurance athlete that has to train 15, 18, 20, 25 hours a week, like there's only a limit as to how intense that exercise can be. Like they're doing so much work. So through lots and lots of high intensity work, they build up all those central adaptations. And then the other thing that they really found was when they had, by virtue of doing that, they build up a really strong aerobic base, for want of a better term. Then when they flicked the switch and the periodization required them to do some high intensity work, they were able to do that really, really effectively. So that high intensity work then ended up underpinning a lot of their aerobic adaptation. So you know, they were the big drivers for improvements in VO2 max and shifting up those aerobic and anaerobic thresholds that we want to get. And that's where we see a lot of our big improvements. So the polarized training model, I guess, you know, it's been absolutely popularized because it does stem from a really strong scientific base on not only elite endurance athletes, but it's also been investigated for sub-elite endurance athletes as well. And there's a fantastic study which looked at Ironman triathlon. And my Instagram has covered this particular study by Munoz. And basically they showed that if there's going to be one event which required people to use a threshold model, and we'll cover that one shortly. So the threshold is the most common model. So that's the one where you spend all your time in that moderate or zone two. Essentially, if that whole event is basically spent in the threshold zone. So sports specificity or event specificity would require you to train in zone two. But counterintuitively, their research showed that athletes that spent more time in zone one and less in zone two performed better in Ironman triathlons. So it just shows you the power of spending more time in zone one. So that's why I think more and more people are spending or investing time in the polarized model. And then that does require you to spend a bit more time in that zone three zone to make that polarized training work. Now, you have already alluded to one potential issue with the polarized model. So when you try and practically apply it in the field, it's pretty hard to get your heart rate from zone one to zone three with not spending any time in zone two. So that whole the whole adage of 80-20 is really hard to apply practically. So for me, there's another model called the pyramidal model. And again, like I sort of can try and draw it for you, but essentially it's lots of time in zone one, lots of time in zone one, and then it gradually trickles down. So there's less time in zone two and then less time in zone three. The reason I like that model and the reason I think it's really effective is because it still emphasizes zone one time. So there's still a massive emphasis on making your easy sessions easy. But what it does do is it provides most athletes with a bit of latitude around their high intensity work. So for a whole host of different factors, sometimes when you try and do your high intensity work, you might be trying as hard as you can, nailing your paces, but for whatever reason, heart rate is a bit suppressed. When you do that, you end up spending a lot of time in zone two. You might spend a bit of time in zone three, but you're spending the vast majority of your session in zone two. That's not bad per se. That's, you know, for whatever reason, fatigue, freshness, it was really cold compared to the warmer conditions when you did the other session the previous week. All of those things have an impact on heart rate response. So I think that pyramidal model is probably more practically applicable in the field when you're dealing with all those environmental conditions and all of life stresses. So I think that's a great model to use, and that's one I personally like to implement. And it's not too dissimilar to the polarized model. It is just accounting for a bit more flexibility. It's probably allowing for a bit more flexibility in that zone three execution. What we don't want to see is easy time being redistributed to that moderate zone. We definitely don't want that when we do the pyramidal model. And then the last one I'll touch on is the most popular model, and it's a negative that it's the most popular, is the threshold model. And that's the model where essentially like a real bell-shaped curve, all of the vast majority of the training time is spent in that zone two or that middle zone. And that leads to a whole host of different issues. Susceptibility to illness, some of them we've already covered in the early phases of the podcast, but susceptibility to illness, injury risk, lack of progress, so stagnation, plateauing, training monotony. And I guess ultimately, all of those lead to a discouragement of exercise because people get a bit frustrated with that type of training.
Do you find that you might move from one model to another depending on the development or the athlete or the time of year? So for example, I actually posted something yesterday regarding the three zone model on my Instagram, and I had quite an interesting question by someone, and they talked about how they're an older athlete and they struggle sometimes with the high intensity stuff. So in my head, I was like, well, you don't, because he was like, well, how can I achieve the 80-20 split if I'm really struggling with the volume of the high intensity stuff? And in my head, I'm thinking, okay, you know, maybe you would start off with just having easy runs, utilize it as a way of getting your bounce back, developing the tissue qualities to enable you to sort of maintain a certain running stride. And then once you've done that, you would maybe implement or slowly add more intense stuff, more as like physical, I'd say it more as like weight training, but you're not using weights, you're using your body rebounding off the floor. It's like plyometric work to try and develop that conditioning. So you'd move from like a model of all easy runs and then slowly maybe more move towards the pyramidal model or the polarized model or anything like that. But in your experience, have you moved at all between different models based on goals, time of year, that sort of thing?
Definitely. So I think, absolutely. So I think one of the key things to note is, so generally in like a general preparation phase for most endurance athletes, polarized model works okay. But what might change is the actual distribution of that. So it might actually be 90 or 95% easy, and you're only spending 5 or 10% in the high intensity zone. So I think for me, it's not so much the distribution changes a fair bit. So the other thing I would say is when you think about preparation for like a half marathon or a marathon, when you try and incorporate some pace specific work, by virtue of doing that, you are going to start spending more time in that zone too. So I think in that instance, the overarching periodized plan does change the training intensity distribution. So I think you end up either spending more time in zone three as you get closer to competition. So think of specific preparation phases or pre-competition phases. And then also when you start incorporating things like tempo sessions, so think of like 2x20-minute tempo runs at your half marathon pace, that is a specific session whereby you are not wanting them to delve into their high intensity zone, but you're trying to build their comfortability and confidence with running at their half marathon pace. So you know that the compromise with that session is you are spending a lot of time in zone two. So the concern would be if you prescribe that and you see them shooting up into zone three heart rate, you'd be like, okay, that's not great, because that's supposed to be prescribed at what is roughly their critical speed or just below. So you don't want to see that huge spike in heart rate. So you're spot on. Like, it does shift based on training goal, training phase. And I think what the art of coaching, the art and science of coaching, is being able to adapt the program to best accommodate those changes in schedule and plan.
Yeah, that's really interesting what you said about maybe you'd be 95% easy runs and then maybe 90 and you just progress it over time. It's a really interesting concept and makes complete sense to me. It kind of 80-20 is starting to remind me of, you know, the whole 10,000 hour rule, where it's like it's the mean value. Like I think the original research was on violinists, and they found that people that made expert level range between 3,000 hours and 17,000 hours. So 10 was the middle, or the mean. And 80-20 is beginning to remind me of a similar thing. People straight away think, I need to try and get that 20% of the intense runnings. But where at the beginning of your training year, it might be 5%. Maybe as you approach a training or a competition, it might be 30%. So over the entire year, it averages out at 20. But you don't have to necessarily chase 20 all the time. You know, think about what's best for the athlete. I'm seeing more and more parallels like that in training. People like numbers that they need to just shoot to, and you know, that's what you do. That's the principle I follow, you know.
And for people, so like if you are genuinely trying to target and hit 20% in zone three, it's actually pretty hard to do. So like it's not as easy as people may think. So the whole concept of sticking to 80-20 is it's a very challenging exercise. So I certainly think that the fluctuation and variation in training intensity distribution across different phases is critically important, because if you tried to stick to 20% of high intensity work all year round, that's a pretty significant stress as well, like especially if you're doing appreciable amounts of endurance training.
How do you define each zone? So I've seen from your Instagram, you kind of have 90% of heart rate and above would be your zone three. Is it 90 to 80 would be zone two, and 80 and below zone one? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Most people, like everyone's familiar with training zones. So like they've been around for a long time, but I would say the traditional five zone model is the one that's obviously much more popular and much more regularly utilized by endurance athletes of all sports, basically. So one of the biggest issues, though, that was identified with the five zone model is that there was an argument against this use, because they didn't say it, like the actual zones didn't traditionally demarcate the true physiological turn points in your body. So the argument for the three zone model was that as a general rule, we're looking for things like ventilatory threshold one and ventilatory threshold two, or what most people would probably refer to as aerobic threshold and anaerobic threshold. So there's some really good evidence to support that the three-zone model does a great job of actually demarcating those specific thresholds. So 80% is a pretty good guide for your aerobic threshold, okay? 90% is a pretty good guide too for your anaerobic threshold. So essentially those two thresholds basically delineate your intensity domains. So under 80%, low intensity; 80 to 90, moderate or threshold intensity; and above 90 is regarded as high intensity. So that's there's lots of good research on training. Once you look at training intensity distribution literature, you'll see that it's all underpinned by this research around the use of three zone models. The other thing I would say is that for me, it is just a much simpler process. So like when you're trying to quantify training intensity, instead of trying to integrate it in this complex five zone model, the three zone model just simplifies it. Like I think it makes it much easier for people to understand. And also when you're quantifying your training, you're kind of not having to worry about two additional zones that really don't tell you anything. So for me, it ticks like a number of boxes, and the fact that it's backed up by really strong scientific evidence certainly, you know, adds credence to that and helps justify my investment and use of it.
Would you ever do maybe some submaximal tests to find out a bit more information regarding these thresholds? So for example, like you alluded to critical speed, being like the threshold, the second threshold between zones 3 and 2. Would you ever utilize anything like that to provide more information of where that might be and contribute to that model?
Yeah. So the whole concept of testing is a really interesting one. So what I'll probably start with is when we think of the aerobic threshold, for example, because that's probably when you're without any testing equipment or any tests being completed, it's generally a slightly easier one to ascertain as to whether you're in it or you're crossed over it. So I guess one of the references I use is nasal breathing. So if you can run along and not breathe through your mouth, so you're breathing solely through your nose, that's generally a good indicator that you are below your aerobic threshold. So that's a great way to gauge your easy runs. So if you start running and you're like, geez, I can't maintain the oxygen demand through my nasal breathing, I've got to start breathing through my mouth, it's probably a good indication that you've crossed over into that moderate threshold. So that's probably a little tip for people if they're trying to run easier. When we think about actual testing, so there's, I guess, two spheres. So I think most people would be familiar with the laboratory-based testing. So that is gold standard. When you think about laboratory-based testing, we think of things like assessments of VO2 max or running economy. By virtue of doing those tests, we often get, and when they're overlaid with oxygen consumption data, we get a really good insight to an individual's actual ventilatory threshold data. That is amazingly insightful, because what that tells us is at this heart rate and at this speed, they went over, you know, that's their ventilatory threshold one. And then at this heart rate and this speed, that's assigned their ventilatory threshold two. They become very clear goals which delineate your intensity domains. Oh, sorry, key markers, to identify your intensity domains. So that's the gold standard method. Now, the issue with that is it requires, generally for most people to access, a pretty significant outlay in cost. And also for people to run it, it requires staffing, resourcing, expensive equipment. So it's not that practical. So for me, like, I've come up with a model that is a bit more logistically viable and cost effective for my athletes. And again, it's certainly not without error. Like, you know, there's certainly inherent error in it, because we don't have the ventilatory and oxygen consumption data at hand. But essentially what I try and do with a lot of my endurance athletes is I use field-based tests. So there are a myriad of different tests which are available, and they range from self-paced tests, like a time trial. So it might be a 2K time trial, or incrementally paced tests. So think of things like the beep test or the yo-yo test or the University of Montreal track test. These tests can be used to provide us with two things. If we're using a heart rate strap and we're collecting heart rate data, that should provide us with a really accurate maximum heart rate value. So that underpins all of our heart rate zones. So we use that for that. The other thing it provides us with is, and again, we won't really cover it too much in this, but it underpins a lot of my conditioning application. It provides us with a maximal aerobic speed value. So that's a derivative of velocity at VO2 max. I use that as my objective intensity measure to prescribe really clearly objective interval training or conditioning prescription for my athletes. So those two things can be determined from the field-based tests without having to go into the lab. And there are quite a few estimates off that. But yeah, I've found for most athletes, it does work quite well. And it does forego the need to undertake laboratory-based testing for most of them.
Yeah, like, testing's great, but in a lot of circumstances, it's probably unnecessary. So if they can follow a guideline like you've provided, they're going to improve, and it's easy to follow. It's logistically much more feasible for them. Like, it makes complete sense just to stick with that. So no, I really, really like your setup, or maybe borrowing it, shall we say. I'd be interested to know how you set up then your high intensity interval training. So for example, like, at the moment we've just talked about running, and you know we know that when we're doing running training, we're not going to just have, okay, if you run easy and then with your hard runs you're just going to run as hard as possible. You know it's a little bit more thought out than that, usually with certain intervals. How do you normally structure your interval training? Like how many intervals? What's the rest period? How long is each interval going to be? Be interesting your thoughts on that.
So that is a great question. And that is, so I have, through the side business, recorded a 3-part workshop covering essentially all of this. So that, that went for 4.5 hours. That went for 4.5 hours. So I certainly don't think we've got that much time. But essentially for me, like when I get asked a lot, like what's the best interval training session you can prescribe? And overwhelmingly, context is king. So it depends on so many factors that have an impact. So for example, sport, phase of the year, training history, training status, all of those things have a big impact. But as a general rule, when you think about, I think one important distinction to make is when we think about high intensity interval training, the key characteristic of that and the application of it is that it needs to be objective. So you need to reference or use an intensity measure to prescribe your interval training. So for me, it is maximal aerobic speed. For other people that have got lab-based data, it might be velocity at VO2 max. So for example, it might be we're doing a long interval session and it might be at a 2-to-1 work to rest, and it might be 4 sets of 4 minutes at 92.5% maximal aerobic speed with 2 minutes passive recovery. Okay, so that's an example of how I would prescribe it. Now, across a group of, like, let's say we do that with a group of triathletes or a group of footballers or soccer players, across the spectrum of athletes, everyone, or there'll be different groupings with different maximal aerobic speed values. So when you start prescribing in that manner, you can start individually tailoring the sessions to each individual's capacity. And the main benefit I associate with that is that you're inducing a consistent stimulus across the group. So that's one of the key characteristics. So when you're working one-on-one with an athlete, it's not that hard to prescribe something. The real complexity comes in when you're dealing with 40, 50, 60 football players or soccer players in a preseason, and you're like, geez, how can I induce a consistent stimulus that I know will be effective across 60 players? So this method absolutely comes into its own when you're dealing with those situations and circumstances. And I've been fortunate enough to work in elite programs, sub-elite programs. I've had to run a conditioning program before with up to 100 footballers. So
wow.
I found it to be incredibly adaptable and implementable for like a broad spectrum of settings. So whether it's one-on-one with an athlete, whether it's catering for 100 footballers or soccer players, it absolutely, the philosophy and the underpinning research holds me in great stead for that. So I don't know if I've answered your question directly, but there's, you know, I guess there's so many layers to it. And I think, I'd certainly, if people are interested in learning more about the application of objective interval training and just overarchingly conditioning, you know, I'd highly recommend that workshop. I think I recorded it last year and it's, you know, it's certainly been incredibly well received because it enables us to enables me to just absolutely delve into the intricacies of interval training and conditioning application across endurance and team sport athletes.
Mm. Yeah, we'll definitely put the link in the show notes and try and encourage everyone to go there. I'm going to have a look at that as well. As like a final question that's kind of linked to that, you know, you talked about how, okay, for each interval, you try and get them at a certain percentage of their mass and you use that as their gauge. So it isn't just like, oh, get into a certain heart rate. So they're not running constantly looking at their watch. You know, try and aim for this. Okay, a bit more objective. I can really understand that. Have you ever used RPE to try a similar effect? And the reason I ask that is because obviously at the moment, this season, it's all about developing strength and endurance simultaneously. And mm-hmm. earlier, you made a really interesting point as the reason why people often use heart rate data for triathlon is that it can easily be done for each of the three disciplines for triathlon.
Yep.
If we try and, say, improve powerlifting and triathlon at the same time, we've got a problem where you can't really just use heart rate data for strength training. So with strength training, we've been talking with Coach Mike Toucher, Dr. Pack. We talked a lot about uses of RPE for developing strength.
Yep.
Could that potentially also be used for the endurance side? So that means you can have like an overview of RPE for both components. I'm still figuring this out because with lifting, you know, you do a set of three and it's over within a minute. If you do like a tempo at 4 minutes, you know, your RPE at the beginning of that 4 minutes is going to be completely different to the RPE at the beginning, at the end of the 4 minutes. So it's more time for error. And I was like, okay, have you got any experience using RPE? Is it possible? All of those type of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So I definitely use RPE within my programs that I prescribe. So one of the key characteristics for me is when people are starting out and they're getting a feel for running to objective prescription, I like to complement it with RPE. So for example, I use the Foster scale, which is, you know, 0 to 10, and it's the one that people don't really understand, where 5 is hard. So, you know, you often say to people, oh, you know, how hard was that? And they're like, oh yeah, no, pretty easy, 5 out of 10. I'm like, no, that's hard. So it's it requires a little bit of education. But for me, what I like about that is when you're referencing the easy and hard runs, that people have to start thinking about it. So like when they finish an easy run, and I guess an important point to note, and you alluded to it, when you're expecting people to record or report an RPE, try and get the actual collection point consistent. So I would say within 2 to 4 minutes of finishing your run, think to yourself, okay, how hard was that? Like, you know, was that a 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, 7 out of 10? So at least then you're reflecting on the session. You're not thinking about it like when your tongue's hanging out of your head and you're like, geez, okay, this is bloody hard. So I think keep the reporting consistent, which I think some people do really well. Other people are probably a little bit inconsistent and haphazard with that. So yeah, I certainly do use it. And I think it is complementary to the objective model, because I think it's nice to get people to start to, you know, I don't want people just to like turn into a metronome and run, just get too distracted by running to their watch. They've got to have a feel for how they're feeling as well, because I rely on that feedback from them to say, well, hey, I've prescribed this, you know, you've done the session really well. Like, how much flex do you think is there? Is how much room to move is there? Oh yeah, I felt like it was only a 5 out of 10. I think I could work a bit harder. So that time, that kind of dialogue and information for me is invaluable, because that tells me about their adaptation without having to retest all the time too. So I can start to, you know, I might say, okay, well, based on that, I'm going to increase your intensity prescription by 1.25% or 2.5%, whatever it is. Let's see how we go. Okay, is that more in line with the RPA we want? Yes, it is. Perfect. Okay. You know, now I can be confident that their MAS value that we used at the back end has started to shift upward. So I guess all of those things are factored in when I do the programming and have that sort of regular dialogue with the athletes.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. So you get them thinking like in the middle of their intervals. So if it's 4 minute interval, you'd get around the 2 minute mark, have a little think about what your perceived feeling is for this. So it does that kind of find a mean? Because if they're going to be find it hard at the end of the interval, easier at the beginning, that middle is the sweet spot. So let them have a little think of what it is then, and then they report back at the end. Would you say that's kind of like?
Yeah, I think there's certainly people, I need people to reflect on how they're feeling during the efforts. Like when we're doing the hard stuff and the high intensity work, that's absolutely what you need to reflect on. So I would say it is, like I probably don't give people a prompt as to when to think about it during the session, but I often try to say, well, when you cluster all of the high intensity work together, how hard was that? And I sort of get them to reflect on that once they finish. Because I think what can happen is if you're getting people to constantly give you an RPE mid-session, I think often it can be a little bit inflated because they're like, oh, you know, I'm just absolutely working ridiculously hard here. But I think when people get through the session, finish the workload, they go, oh, okay, yeah. I think when I reflect on it, it was a 7 out of 10 and that's what was prescribed. Because I think what you can get is you can get people that over-report RPEs when you're constantly getting them done mid-bout, I think, is what I find. And again, that's not particularly useful for me, because when you analyze sessions, for example, people can report an RPE of, let's say they're doing the 4x4 minute session, they report an RPE of 8 in the second one, but then they still manage to finish the fourth one faster than all preceding three. So shows you that they, you know, probably not, like it probably wasn't an 8 really, at rep number 2. So it's certainly a great complementary assessment of effort. And I think it's certainly something, the thing I like about it most is that I think it's good for, it's a good. It's good for people to have an appreciation of how they think they're working, because I think we can, I can add lots of objectivity to that. But I think fundamentally, when they're racing, when they're doing events, they need, like when you've started the race too fast and you haven't gone as prescribed, how do you pull that back using your feeling without not getting carried away? So they need to have a good appreciation for that as well.
Yeah. No, really good points. It's quite interesting to see your approach to it. Yeah. You know, hindsight is a beautiful thing. And if you're saying how good or how bad something is during it, and then you give them a bit of time to actually reflect on it as, ah, it wasn't that bad. You know, everyone's guilty of that, not just in training, but in all walks of life, aren't they? So
yeah,
having an awareness of that is, yeah, quite important for it. But Nathan, that was absolutely brilliant. Your YouTube lecture, your workshops, I'll put them all in the show notes. But if anyone wants to contact you, or if you've got any other courses or anything like that you'd like to promote, you know, how can anyone get in contact?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So it's The Conditioning Consultant is the business. Instagram is the handles at The Conditioning Consultant. So that's primarily where I provide education and resources for people to refer to. And yeah, there's obviously links associated through the Instagram as well. But we also have a website too, which has a bit more information around program offerings and services, et cetera. And that's theconditioningconsultant.com.au. And then, yeah, there's, you know, the workshops, which, you know, it's a three-part series, which covers testing, HIIT prescription, so like all the consideration of all the variables, and then finishes with conditioning periodization. So how do you actually periodize a entire season for an athlete? And it has a particular bias towards team sport, because I would say overwhelmingly my clientele, like the followers I have on Instagram at the moment, would be either athletes or practitioners working within team sport settings. So that's kind of where, I guess, where it was more framed at, but certainly there's lots of take homes for endurance athletes as well. So yeah, that's probably the two main avenues, mate. I sort of have a YouTube channel, but it's kind of more for like some strength training exercises on there and stuff like that. But yeah, so it's the website and the Instagram are probably the two main things. And I guess, sorry, the other thing I should say is the side business was set up to provide more objectively prescribed running prescription for people. So there's two main options. Like there's an individualized running plan option, which is certainly our most popular. So that obviously factors in all of the requirements for you and comes up with a program which is tailored to your individual needs and your event, team sport athlete, endurance athlete, whatever it might be. But also I have some really effective running plans. So there's a couple. So there's 5K, 10K, and also a team sport running plan as well. And they are more affordable and cheaper than the individualized running plan, but no less successful. We've had some amazing feedback and, you know, we keep track of it. We keep track of a lot of our athletes through Strava, which is cool seeing people from all over the world undertaking the program and sticking to it meticulously. So it's been a really rewarding exercise.
Yeah, that's wicked. I'll have to check them all out. I'll definitely try and check out the high intensity interval training workshop. Do a round two once I've watched it, because I probably have loads of questions I want to develop and delve into it more. So that would be great. But Nathan, thank you so much. I'll keep in touch over Instagram.
Absolutely. No problems, Phil. And thank you for having me on. And hopefully I was able to provide some insight on training intensity distribution for yourself and the listeners.
Definitely. It definitely benefited me. So hopefully the listeners are going to absolutely love it. So thank you so much.